it's consistent with the fall. And that's the information we got back from the medical examiner as well.
Juneau police say the city's mayor died of natural causes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 2nd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the challenge of finding steady work after serving a long prison sentence.
They didn't want to hire someone who had done as much time as I'd done, who had made the mistakes that I'd made. They didn't want to take the chance on me.
Those stories tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
Preliminary autopsy results indicate the late Juneau mayor died Monday morning from natural causes, likely a heart issue. Based on that information, Juneau police do not suspect any foul play. Greg Fisk was discovered dead inside his home Monday afternoon. At a press briefing in Juneau this afternoon, Juneau Police Chief Bryce Johnson said the 70-year-old was found with some bruises and injuries on his face that were bleeding.
People fall and faces get injured. It can look like there was an assault that took place, and that's why, you know, the first looks and people thought maybe there was an assault take place, but it's consistent with the fall. And that's the information we got back from the medical examiner as well.
Johnson says the department has evidence to corroborate the medical examiner's finding that the facial injuries were not the cause of death. Johnson says it's likely Fisk fell against a counter after experiencing a heart issue. Fisk had a history of heart problems, the police chief said. After Fisk's body was found Monday afternoon, rumors quickly spread about the cause. His death has attracted national attention. Johnson says because the death was unattended and Fisk was found with injuries, police had an obligation to investigate.
So there was a time period in which we just didn't have any answers. And people being people, they run with the unknown for that couple of days. And it's Juneau, Alaska. It's an exotic location. It's a newly elected mayor. So it was an intriguing story. It's a tragic story for Juneau because we're still lost our mayor. Tragic story for the family.
A final autopsy report is due in 2 to 8 weeks. The Alaska Native teenager at the epicenter of a tasing incident in Sitka last year has hired legal counsel. Though he's not yet filed suit, the lawyer representing Franklin Hoogendoorn intends to bring his case before a Sitka jury. KCAW's Emily Kwonk has more.
Myron Angstman has run a private practice out of Bethel since 1977. He's no stranger to cases involving police conduct on the job and has represented both parties. In 2007, he defended a Bethel police officer in a case concerning a taser gun and won.
I kind of have an idea what the rules are. So this case looks like it's one where there's a problem with the conduct of the officers. That's my view.
And that view, along with a 6-minute video of Hoogendoorn in police custody, convinced Angstman to take the case.
It sure looked like a doable case to me after I reviewed it.
The 6-minute video was uploaded to YouTube on October 29th, over a year after the arrest, where it quickly made the rounds on social media and accumulated over 37,000 views. Angstman says Hoogendoorn contacted his office shortly after. Angstman then notified Sitka of Hoogendoorn's intent to sue. Municipal attorney Robin Kochak says the city's insurance company has retained its own legal counsel to organize a defense. Last week, the city also released its police department operating procedures manual to the public, a 342-page document. For Angstman, the video, with the police procedures as a measuring stick, is what this case is all about.
It doesn't really matter what I think the tape says or what you think the tape says, because the jury has the final decision as to what that tape says.
Sitka Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt reviewed the footage shortly after and determined that the arrest, while uncomfortable to watch, fell within policy guidelines. Furthermore, Schmidt says, the video only shows a small slice of the police encounter with Hoogendoorn, which began when officers confronted him outside of a Sitka bar. In a previous interview, Schmidt says, we're not seeing the whole story.
He's not giving them their hands. He's pushing off. At one point, he tries to kick the officers. And having just fought with them, they're still concerned that he's going to fight more. So hence the use of the taser. They're trying to get him to comply.
At the time of his arrest, Hoogendoorn was a senior at the state's all-Alaska boarding school, Mount Edgecombe. Academic principal Bernie Gurley says Hoogendoorn had no run-ins with the law and was in good academic standing at the time of his arrest in September of 2014. He was signed out for the weekend by a family member, allowing him to leave the campus and visit Sitka when police saw him enter a local bar. The following Monday, Gurley says Hoogendoorn came into his office and asked to shut the door behind him.
To me, he said that he had been busted for underage drinking. He wanted me to know that because he was sure it was going to be in the paper very soon.
Except for the most serious infractions, Mount Edgecombe has a two strikes and you're out rule for student substance abuse. Hoogendoorn's previous offense took place on campus, so this incident was strike two.
He was sorry. There was no question in my mind. He had a lot of remorse for the mistake that he made, and he mentioned that more than a couple of times.
Gurley indefinitely suspended Hoogendoorn 2 days after the arrest, on September 8th. But he adds that Hoogendoorn didn't talk about what happened that night, not about the jail cell, being held overnight, or the tasing. Neither the city nor the police department notified Mount Edgecombe that Hoogendoorn had been arrested or forced to comply through the use of a taser. Gurley would not comment on that. He did, however, affirm that the incident has not compromised the school's otherwise strong relationship with the Sitka Police Department.
They respond very professionally. They treat all of our students, you know, very fairly. It doesn't matter if they're native Alaskans or not.
As for Hoogendoorn, his lawyer says that he has since returned to his home village of Koyak and earned his high school diploma. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
A new report from the State Department of Health confirms alarming facts about synthetic drugs that have overwhelmed emergency responders in Anchorage. Researchers with the state's section of epidemiology looked at hundreds of medical records from emergency rooms in two Anchorage hospitals during a six-week period this summer. 167 visits were flagged as cases that were likely spice-related. 20% of the patients were admitted multiple times for spice-related medical emergencies. Luisa Castodale is an epidemiologist with the state and says this is the first systemized review of how spice is impacting emergency rooms in Anchorage.
It's really tricky because there isn't just one code or one standout diagnosis that you could look for. And so just in the process of more systematically look at this, we've kind of created for ourselves some sort of a baseline.
11 different chemical compounds turned up in toxicology screenings when samples were sent to a lab in California. The report notes that the range of compounds is one reason for the array of adverse reactions in users, which run the gamut from unconsciousness to states of severe agitation.
Some of the products that were sampled really had some of the newer, more potent synthetic cannabinoids present in them, and not only present singly, but also blended together. So when we're thinking about spice and the adverse health effects, we're really worried about the unpredictability in these chemicals.
The findings also show that 10 deaths examined, 4 involved synthetic cannabinoids as either a main or contributing factor. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a soldat and a girl lights the Alaska-born U.S. Capitol tree.
I was feeling very excited, and I just couldn't wait to turn it on.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Most people leaving prison have to find a job fairly quickly, both to support themselves and to meet their parole requirements. Their job searches can be more complicated than most because of the stigma of having a criminal history, but that doesn't mean it's impossible. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned more for our series Hitting Reset.
John sits on the couch in his living room with his arm around his wife, Shannon, baby toys to one side. With a groomed goatee and a slight belly, he's just another middle-aged dad. The couple knew each other back in high school. Shannon is friends with John's sister. And they found each other again right after John was released from prison.
I just knew that he was going to be my husband, and I just kind of knew.
But for John...
That first day, you knew?
She knew.
After spending nearly 20 years behind bars, nothing was that straightforward.
You know, when I first got released, relationships were very hard for me. It was one thing to have relationships with my family. So it was really scary to have anything other than that. And so I wasn't prepared to be in a romantic relationship. I wasn't prepared emotionally or mentally to be in one. And yet here's this woman that I wanted to be in one with and didn't know how to do it.
John was 19 in early 1994 when he went to prison for his involvement with a murder. To put it in context, that was before the internet was big, before Kurt Cobain died, and before apartheid officially ended in South Africa. John says when he was finally released in 2013, he struggled with even simple things, like being alone in public spaces without someone of authority around. And he faced one of his biggest challenges, finding a job.
It was a nightmare. It was crazy. When I first got out, trying to find any job, Denny's wouldn't hire me. They wouldn't even look at me a second glance. I'm no fast food place, no restaurants. They didn't want to hire someone who had done as much time as I'd done, who had made the mistakes that I'd made. They didn't want to take the chance on me.
He says he applied to dozens of places, but no one would look past the check marks in the box indicating he had a criminal history.
You know, trying to put down murder in the first degree and perjury, you know, how's that look? I don't want someone that was in for murder working for me. I had so many people just shut the door. I had one place in a computer shop where I got into the interview. Interview went good. When we talked about my situation, he said, my insurance will never cover you, so I can't hire you.
It took John 2.5 months before he got his first break, and the job was temporary. He was let go from the next position because felons can't work in places that sell firearms.
There was at least one time there when I was ready to go back, I was ready to give up and go back, but I didn't because of this woman next to me.
Do you remember that point?
Yes, I do. It was pretty scary. Just the fact that, you know, he couldn't find any job, and it was just really scary to know that, you know, the stigma and the fact that, you know, what he did 20 years ago is still affecting his life now.
The stigma comes up in conversation over and over with almost everyone with a criminal background. Tamika Ledbetter, the manager of the Mat-Su and Eagle River Job Centers, says the stigma of returning from prison is real, but not every employer is opposed to hiring people with criminal histories.
Employers are more willing to take a chance on a returning citizen than most returning citizens are even aware of.
She says many small local businesses, construction companies, and seafood companies are willing to look past criminal records. And there are incentives. The federal government offers tax credits to companies that hire felons within 1 year of release. The state offers fidelity bonding, which is like free extra insurance in case an employee does steal from the employer. Ledbetter says people can get past the box by writing quality resumes that focused on their skills, just like any other applicant.
Skills are skills are skills, and they don't necessarily need to come from paid employment. So any volunteer work, any work that you've done on the side, whatever it is that you've done, we want to look at those skills. And even those things that you were doing when you were inside.
John's resume focuses on his computer skills, things he learned in classes and taught himself while he was still incarcerated. And he has a good job now, a really good job that helps him pay his bills and support his family. But he's still worried about the stigma. He thinks that if everyone knows he has a murder charge, he could lose everything he's worked for. And that's why we're only using his first name.
You're sharing my background because I'm in a position that I work with clients all day. And I'm afraid that that if the clients that I work with knew my past, that it would adversely affect my position.
John explains that his higher-ups recommended he not share his full name because they had the same fear, that clients wouldn't want to work with him. But for Shannon, the danger of his past being publicly announced on the radio is about more than just his livelihood.
I don't want people to look at John as who he was versus who he is now, because he's a totally different person.
John nods in agreement. He's not a 19-year-old kid anymore trying desperately to be cool. He's a father, a church leader, and a professional computer technician. It took him years to get to this point, and he has no desire to go back. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
That was the third part of our radio series, Hitting Reset. Join us for a more in-depth discussion of successful prisoner reentry during a live community forum at 7 p.m. tomorrow at the Alaska Public Media Studios. Go to alaskapublic.org for more information or to see the entire series. The municipality of Anchorage denounced today it has won a competitive grant to bring a workshop focusing on economic and fiscal health in the city. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The grant, which comes from the national nonprofit Smart Growth America, is a free two-day workshop covering development strategies to support the local economy. Though the ground covered could apply anywhere, Chris Schutte, who is the municipality's Director of Economic and Community Development, says it's especially relevant in one section of Anchorage.
Downtown Anchorage has some pretty amazing potential from a residential and commercial standpoint that has not been fully realized.
And through these workshops, Schutte is hoping the group can help find some answers to one lingering question.
What's the secret sauce? What's been missing? What are we not doing that can help facilitate the growth and the development that we have seen in downtowns across the country?
That national perspective is something he hopes Smart Growth America can bring to the table. Alex Dodds is the communications director at Smart Growth America.
We'll talk about a little bit what we have learned from other communities across the country. So we've worked with many communities doing this kind of work, and we'll share a little bit of information about what we've learned and the strategies that have worked really well in other places.
Those strategies range from identifying key residential and commercial properties for revitalization to increasing cleanup efforts in order to draw more visitors to new areas to developing housing priorities. She says the first day of the two-day workshop is aimed at giving the public opportunities to ask questions, learn about the available tools, and talk about what they would like to see in the city. The second day, Dodd says, focuses on the efforts of city and community leaders.
Talk to them about what they're working on and how development strategies, different development patterns, or specific development approaches could help them achieve the goals that they're working towards. So whether that's bringing more jobs downtown, creating new housing, or you know, whatever they're working on to support the broader economy of Anchorage.
Anchorage and six other communities around the United States were selected from a pool of 68 applications spanning 34 states. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
A British Columbia mine that's become a poster child for environmental disasters will soon begin discharging wastewater, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Mount Polly Mine's tailings dam broke in August of 2014, releasing more than 6 billion gallons of silty water and mine processing leftovers. The provincial government granted permission to resume partial operations in July, but Mount Polly wasn't allowed to discharge anything off its site. Instead, waste and water were routed to a large mined-out pit. Officials from a nearby town and two tribal governments recently warned the pit was close to full and could spill water and waste rock into the environment. But British Columbia officials this week issued a permit allowing some of that to be treated and released. Mining Minister Bill Bennett said there was no chance it would overflow anytime soon.
The pit that the water and the tailings are going into is not close to anywhere close, actually, to the water being, you know, at the top. It's not a situation where you have a potential for a breach or an overtopping at all. And it's just, it's unfortunate that statements were made by those who really don't have the facts.
BC's Environment Ministry says without releasing some water, the temporary tailings pit would overflow by next April. The new permit calls for wastewater to go through a treatment plant and into a settlement pond. It will then be released about 100 feet below the surface of a nearby lake, the deepest in British Columbia. Mount Polly is within the watershed of the Fraser River, which empties into the Pacific at Vancouver, BC. Southeast Alaska Conservation Council's Guy Archibald says it still should concern residents.
Because this is what we've come to expect from the BC permitting process. For the mines that do drain into the transboundary rivers and eventually into Southeast Alaska, we can expect the same very short-sighted rubber stamp permitting process.
Mount Polly's proposed water treatment system is temporary. Owner Imperial Metals must submit a long-term plan by the end of June. The BC government says the treated water will be monitored. It must be safe for drinking as well as aquatic organisms. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
A Fairbanks man survived an avalanche burial in the Hoodoo Mountains. The accident in a popular snow machining area off the Richardson Highway was the one of two in recent weeks, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Sean Herring was snow machining with friends in the Summit Lake area last weekend following a storm that brought heavy snow and wind to the eastern Alaska range. Herring says the group was staying away from big slopes, and he'd driven away from the others up a small drainage to go to the bathroom when he triggered the slide.
It was on a 30, 40-foot hillside, but it just slowly started burying me, and then the one up above had also slid and was sliding down the creek at me. And so when I seen that, I was pretty sure I was going to die.
Herring says he initially panicked as the avalanche engulfed him.
My face was probably 2 feet under the snow. My arm, I could just barely reach the surface. Kept doing like a punching motion around my face and either clearing it from my face or pushing it in my mouth so I could chew it up and swallow it. Finally noticed that, you know, I could still breathe under the snow.
Herring estimates spending about a half an hour digging himself out, after which his friends showed up and helped him excavate his snow machine and ride to safety.
After it was all over, I was very thankful that I was alive, but also that I was able to experience that and have much more respect for the mountains.
It was the second reported slide in the Summit Lake area in 2 weeks in which a rider was buried. In an earlier incident, the snow machiner survived 25 minutes under the snow before being located and dug out. University of Alaska Fairbanks Outdoor Recreation Department Director Mark Oldmixon is part of a local effort to educate backcountry travelers about avalanche danger. He says the incidents show that even small, steep slopes can be dangerous.
So a 20-foot slope, but 3 feet of snow at 100 feet wide, that's, you know, that's a lot of cubic feet of snow. And then it's a terrain trap, they call it, where that snow just piles up into the bottom of this drainage.
Oldmixon additionally points to anomalies identified in this year's heavy early season snowpack in the eastern Alaska range.
There's a couple of what we saw to be obvious weakness, but also seeing other signs that there's something else there showing up down in the summit area around the Hoodoos. A little gremlin.
Oldmixon encourages backcountry travelers to take advantage of avalanche safety classes and to keep up on localized conditions by checking the Eastern Alaska Range Avalanche Center website before heading out. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A 74-foot tree from the Chugach National Forest is lit up now on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol. APRN's Liz Ruskin spoke to the Soldotna girl who won a trip to Washington to flip the switch.
Technically, the Speaker of the House is supposed to light the Capitol Christmas tree. But as Paul Ryan pointed out, he's brand new at the post.
I've never done this before, so I'm going to need some help. And I would like Anna to come up here and help me, please, light this tree.
A little girl in a fluffy blue dress and elaborate braids came into the spotlight on the lawn to the west of the Capitol Dome. She's Anna Duvall, a 10-year-old from Soldotna.
And I'd like you to all help me by counting down, and we're going to have Anna flip the switch. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hey, look at that. Look at that. That's awesome.
Anna earned the honor by winning an essay contest about the tree, judged by Senator Lisa Murkowski. The homeschooled fifth grader handled the media scrum after the lighting ceremony with poise beyond her years.
I was feeling very excited, and I just couldn't wait to turn it on.
Anna, her parents, and her little sister Sarah are in the midst of a whirlwind tour of Washington, courtesy of the corporate sponsors who delivered the tree 4,000 miles from the Chugach National Forest. And Anna says the fun's not over yet.
We're going to see a whole bunch more things, like some of the Smithsonian's. We haven't gone to those yet. Spy Museum.
Her mom, Shona Duvall, says it didn't come as a complete shock that Anna's entry won a statewide contest.
Anna worked so hard on her essay and draft after draft after draft after draft. And she worked so hard on it that in some ways, and it turned out so beautifully that in some ways I wasn't surprised.
Senator Murkowski says she was impressed by the symbols Anna found in the tree. Her essay says its lights represent the aurora borealis and its towering height, the mountains of the 49th state. The tree is hung with 10,000 LED lights and thousands of Alaska-made ornaments. Anna and Senator Murkowski hung the very last one themselves. Murkowski says it came from a Homer woman named Susan who was selling ornaments at a holiday bazaar. Susan told the senator she was crushed that she submitted an ornament for the Capitol tree, but for some reason it was rejected. Murkowski took matters into her own hands.
And I said, how about if I place your ornament on the tree? And so she gave me an ornament, and it is now hanging on the tree, and we took a picture of it. And Susan will know that hers is hung in a place of honor on the Capitol Christmas tree.
This is the first time the Capitol tree has come from Alaska. The trucker who brought it the whole way, John Shank of Fairbanks, watched its lighting from a special spot next to the congressional delegation, Governor Bill Walker, and Anna's family. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Emily Kwonk in Sitka, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Department of Education is looking for 3 experienced Alaskan educators to help underperforming schools improve instruction and student performance. These school improvement coaches would work as contractors to the state. Apply by September 15th. Call 907-465-8721 or inquire at the Department of Education for information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
On Thursday, December 3rd, Alaska Pacific University is hosting an open house from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in the Carr Gottstein Lobby. Learn about environmental science, outdoor and environmental education, and K-8 teaching certification programs. To find out where these APU programs can take you, hashtag ThisIsOurClassroom. This message sponsored by APU.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.